Hi, everybody. Marco Werman here. Before we get into the show, I've got some exciting news to share. The world is participating in Newsmatch. From now until the end of the year, every dollar donated to the world will be matched. This means that a gift of $50 will actually provide $100 of support to our work here at The World. If you have ever considered giving to The World, today is the day to take intention and turn it into action, one that we will be deeply grateful for. Every day, The World crosses borders and time zones to bring you stories that matter. As a nonprofit newsroom, we rely on contributions from listeners like you to keep our reporting free and accessible to all. With Newsmatch, you can double your impact. It takes a lot to keep the world spinning, and we cannot do it without you. Head to theworld.org/give to donate today. From everybody here at The World, thank you. The world reacts to the U.S. election. We hear from the Middle East.
Well, look, we have no illusions. He is no savior.
Bangladesh.
Well, I'm extremely relieved. It's been a complete nail-biter.
Also from Mexico, Europe, and from South Africa, a sorority sister from Alpha Kappa Alpha. I'm Marco Werman. Also on the show today, a little hope in the quest for a coronavirus vaccine. Pfizer claims its vaccine is 90% effective so far. And how the NBA has charmed its way back onto the airwaves in China.
That fandom never stopped. If anything, I think the fans doubled down in their efforts to keep connected to their favorite stars.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Nothing is surprising anymore in the Trump White House. This afternoon, President Trump fired the head of the Pentagon, Defense Secretary Mark Esper, whom Trump believed was not loyal enough. And yes, the president announced the decision on Twitter. Leon Panetta is a former defense secretary. He also served as director of the CIA and White House chief of staff. Leon Panetta, did Secretary Esper and other top Pentagon officials see this decision coming?
Well, I'm sure there have been a lot of indications. I was asked about whether he resigned last week, and he had not. There were a lot of rumors that the president was going to go after Esper one way or the other. So it probably was not a surprise to have the president go ahead and tweet that he was firing the Secretary of Defense, as consequential as that is, because I think it comes at a very critical time when the country is going through this transition now from one administration to the next, and to create uncertainty at the Department of Defense is not smart because of the Defense Department's involvement in COVID-19 and challenges around the world, and also with regards to dealing with divisions here at home as well. So it's not a good move by the President of the United States.
Well, I was going to ask you, do you think Secretary Esper's dismissal, as some have suspected, is payback for his comments after he accompanied President Trump on that now infamous walk across Lafayette Square outside the White House in June? Is that what this is rooted in?
Who knows? You know, what exactly leads this president to do anything. Obviously, Secretary Esper was certainly loyal to the president's priorities and policies with regards to national security, but obviously he raised questions. He raised questions about the role of the military, particularly after the demonstration at Lafayette Park, and felt that the military was being misused, as did other military leaders. He was concerned about just arbitrarily reducing forces abroad that without any kind of conditions-based requirement with regards to reducing those forces. And he obviously was interested in moving ahead and renaming military posts and removing the names of Confederate generals from those posts, something that Congress was supporting, but obviously the president was not. So there are obviously some differences that played in to what the president did today.
Who's next in line for Secretary of Defense, and what's at risk with U.S. adversaries if there's essentially a placeholder for the next 3 months?
Well, my understanding is he's asking the head of counterterrorism to to act in that role in the interim. It makes it much more difficult for the Department of Defense and the military leadership to do its job, because somebody coming from something that is not directly related to the Department of Defense and trying to administer a department of almost 3 million people, 2 million in uniform, 1 million civilians, it's just not going to be easy to be able to go in. And the fact is, it isn't going to make much difference. I mean, what it will impact is whether or not there will be a smooth transition to a new administration, which there should be. But it's pretty clear from this president and the way he's behaving that that's the last thing he's interested in. And when you suddenly remove the secretary from the department and you start removing other people, it's just going to make it that much more difficult to have a transition to a new administration.
Former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, thank you very much for your time today.
You're welcome.
It took a few days to get there, but the results are in, and congratulations from leaders across the globe are flowing to Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. We'll be hearing throughout the show today more reactions to the historic election results here in the U.S., but not from Mexico. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has refused to acknowledge a winner in the U.S. election.
En cuanto a las elecciones en Estados Unidos,
he said this morning that Mexico's constitution prohibits him from meddling in the affairs of other countries. From Mexico City, the world's Jorge Valencia has more on the reactions there.
Mario Espinosa Alfaro was born and raised in southwestern Idaho. His parents immigrated there to the U.S. and still live there. And even though he now works for an NGO in Mexico City,
I'm still registered in Idaho.
Espinosa Alfaro voted for Joe Biden, but he's celebrating just as much who won as he is who lost.
I'm so relieved that Donald Trump was not reelected.
Many U.S. citizens who are registered Democrats and live in Mexico supported Bernie Sanders in the primaries and Biden in the general. Espinosa Alfaro, among them, says that has a lot to do with who Biden was running against.
We might not agree with our system right now, but we agree that we need to have a democracy. That's what we love. I mean, we might have differences on how the government should function, but we believe that the government should continue functioning. That was the difference between Trump and Biden.
So, Espinosa Alfaro says, he's going to continue advocating for issues like Medicare for All or trade policies that are more favorable for workers in both countries. And he says that's more likely to happen under a Biden administration.
I voted for him. I made sure that my entire family voted for him, except for the ones who are now Trump supporters.
Which we know now was a factor in this presidential race. Americans of Mexican background supported both Biden and Trump. And that's something that Juan Iván Peña Néder has been thinking about in Mexico City. Peña Néder is not a U.S. citizen, but during the campaign, he was working to get Mexican Americans in the U.S. to vote for the Republican ticket.
I think the Mexican vote in the Republican Party will going up slowly but continuously. And now that is better for Mexico because we have more possibilities if we have people in both sides.
And while Peña Néder says he knows the U.S. election is for U.S. voters to decide, he supports Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who didn't offer congratulations right away. Peña Néder says that President López Obrador knows there's a lot at stake.
We are a huge commercial partner with the United States, the biggest one, and he must be careful in this moment because what's hurry?
Although few observers of American politics in Mexico see it that way. Jose Andres Garcia is a consultant based in Mexico City, helping businesses on both sides of the border. And he says there may be consequences for President López Obrador waiting much longer to reach out to the Biden camp.
I don't want to go into what could happen, but I think it's an important sign of diplomacy. So I think he should rectify soon for the well-being of our diplomatic relations.
Those diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Mexico have largely been positive for decades, even as Trump often antagonized Mexico and Mexican Americans. Still, Garcia says Joe Biden taking office will mark the end of four long years.
And I do see that this is kind of put in the past, the negative rhetoric of Mexico. So I think it's going to be very, very positive.
Very positive, Garcia says, but not to be taken for granted. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
People who work on international climate policy are celebrating the election of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Their campaign pledged to put the U.S. back in the Paris Climate Agreement and, quote, rally the rest of the world to meet the threat of climate change. The campaign also offered up a $2 trillion climate change plan, the most aggressive ever laid out by a major party presidential ticket. The world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, has reaction from the climate world.
This video on Twitter kind of sums it up. A woman is shrieking, jumping up and down while spinning in a circle and pumping her fists in the air. She's Cristiana Figueres, the Costa Rican diplomat who ran the Paris Agreement process at the UN. Sorry, no containment today, she tweeted on Saturday. Congratulations, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris. In Dhaka, scientist and climate advisor to the Bangladeshi government, Salim Ul Haq, was a little more sedate.
Well, I'm extremely relieved. It's been a complete nail biter.
The U.S. is responsible for the world's second most greenhouse gas emissions. So Huck says who sits in the White House matters everywhere.
It means a huge, huge amount. It is absolutely difficult to overstate how bad another 4 years of Trump would have been for the global climate change world.
President Trump once called climate change a hoax, reversed a slew of domestic policies aimed at cutting greenhouse gas emissions, and took the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Pact. But under a new administration, Huck says the U.S. will be welcomed back with open arms.
So the U.S. has a lot of catching up to do, but we are extremely hopeful that now we have an administration that knows the problem, is willing to solve the problem, and join with the rest of the world in solving the problem.
Climate change was a bigger election issue than ever before in 2020. Nearly 7 in 10 Biden voters told Pew Research Center it was very important to their vote. And at the Democratic National Convention this summer, Biden named it as one of four historic crises Americans are facing: the pandemic, recession, racial injustice, and
the undeniable realities and just the accelerating threats of climate change.
And an election that made headlines around the world, that focus on climate change got attention. Carlos Fuller is the lead negotiator at UN Climate Talks for the Alliance for Small Island States. He says he's been following Biden's campaign for a while.
He spoke about getting the U.S. back into the Paris Agreement and doing a lot of work on addressing climate change, which for us was great news. With this change, I actually see, a lot of hope coming back.
Part of that hope is because the Biden-Harris campaign pledged to set greenhouse gas emission targets in line with science.
But more importantly, it's what the U.S. could do to reduce their emissions would mean developing of technology, and that technology would then be available for the private sector for the whole world.
Fuller lives in Belize, and when we spoke, the remnants of Hurricane Eta fell outside. The storm is thought to have killed scores of people, left more than 100 missing, flooded homes, and forced evacuations across Central America. It's the kind of storm expected to grow more intense as the climate warms. Advocates and policymakers see Biden's $2 trillion climate plan as a step in the right direction, but they're already tempering expectations about what a new administration will actually be able to accomplish with a Congress that's likely to be divided.
How much of it he can get done, of course, we're going to have to wait and see.
Andrew Light is a former Obama administration climate change negotiator.
It's going to depend a lot on, if you have a Republican-controlled Senate, how many individuals there who are willing to cross the line.
If any are. Senator Mitt Romney yesterday became one of the first high-profile Republicans to call for Americans to get behind Biden. In the same CNN interview, though, he also criticized Biden's long-term plan to shift the country off of fossil fuels.
I want to make sure that we conservatives keep on fighting to make sure that we don't have a Green New Deal, we don't get rid of gas and coal and oil.
Experts expect a coronavirus stimulus package to present the first opportunity for the Biden-Harris administration to try to drum up support for green energy investments. And re-entering the global climate pact is one thing the White House can do without congressional approval. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Coming up on the show, our reporters in Northern and Southern Europe give us a landscape of reactions to the big news this past weekend. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. America's election news has made headlines across the globe. In a couple of places, it feels personal. Tulasendrapuram is the village in southern India where Kamala Harris's maternal grandfather lived People there set off firecrackers, shared sweets, and performed music at a local temple. Another demonstration of local pride in Ballina, Ireland.
And the waves caressed the shore. Oh, the feeling it came over me.
Ballina and County Mayo was the hometown of President-elect Joe Biden's great-great-great-grandfather before he emigrated to Scranton, Pennsylvania. In the Irish town of Carlingford, Biden is known as Cousin Joe because some of his distant cousins still live there. Traditional bagpipes in honor of the family. The president-elect also had a new song written about him called Our Local Joe. Donald Trump's 4 years in office have put America's traditional alliances in Europe to the test. At the same time, the Trump administration has forged some unconventional relationships in that part of the world. European leaders are now looking ahead at a different reality, with President-elect Joe Biden poised to take office in January. The world's Europe-based correspondents join me now, Orla Barry in London and Lydia Manalidou in Athens. Orla, Lydia, let's start with some places where there was not dancing in the streets, not a overwhelmingly positive reaction. By that, I mean countries in the EU whose leaders had been quite close to Trump, like Hungary and Poland. Lydia, what are we hearing from there today?
Trump did have kind of a populist leaders fan club here in Eastern Europe who have looked up to him both for inspiration and for validation. So Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban is one example. He was the first EU leader to publicly endorse Trump back in 2016, but he was actually one of the last to congratulate Biden on his win this time around. It took him until yesterday, basically a full day after other European leaders had issued their congratulations, to put out a statement. And, you know, Marco, Orban doesn't really have many friends in the European Union, but he did find a friend in Trump. Both had been described as nationalists, as anti-immigration. They constantly slammed the media and their critics. And last year, Trump invited Orban to the White House and called him a great leader, whereas Biden's words on Orban haven't been so complimentary. Here's Biden at the ABC town hall back in October.
You see what's happening in everything from Belarus to Poland to Hungary, and the rise of totalitarian regimes in the world, and as well as this president embraces all the thugs in the world.
What about the reaction from Poland, Lydia?
So Polish President Andrzej Duda, another Trump fan, did congratulate Biden in a tweet, but he congratulated him not for winning, but for a, and I'm quoting here, successful presidential campaign. And then he went on to say that Poland is going to wait for the official vote from the Electoral College. So this was a very lukewarm congratulations, if you can even call it that, from Poland.
I also want to get to the countries in the EU that previously had pretty strong relations with the U.S. that then were strained under Donald Trump. Germany is a great example. Orla, what are you hearing from them?
Yeah, it's very striking today. Angela Merkel gave a 5-minute press kind of answer or comment on Joe Biden's election. She congratulated him from the bottom of her heart, as she put it. Of all EU leaders, I guess, she had one of the worst relationships with President Trump. And if you remember, Trump himself openly criticised Angela Merkel at times and lambasted Germany for not spending more on defence. During the press conference, she never mentioned President Trump by name once. Have a listen.
Joe Biden bringt die Erfahrung aus Jahrzehnten in der Innen- wie in der Außenpolitik mit.
What he's saying there is that Joe Biden has decades of experience in both domestic and foreign policy. He knows Germany and Europe very well. It's almost like she's kind of emphasising the difference between Biden and the incumbent. And it wasn't just Joe Biden, Marco, that she talked warmly about. She also dedicated a significant portion of her speech this morning to Kamala Harris, describing her as an inspiration and a symbol of what is possible in America. Today, by the way, is November 9th. It's the anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, 1989. And Merkel went on to point out that the role that the US played in what she called the darkest and brightest chapters in Germany's history. I heard one German commentator saying earlier, Merkel tends to be very measured and restrained when she speaks. But today she was downright emotional when she was talking about this election of a new president to the White House.
Interesting. So let's move beyond the reactions to Election Day. Let's talk about the policy challenges facing Biden as he moves ahead. A big question looming, Orla, is what happens now with Brexit negotiations. Are there concerns about how Boris Johnson's going to get along with Biden once he becomes president?
There's certainly speculation. It's widely believed here that Biden doesn't particularly like Boris Johnson. He's quoted at one point as saying he saw Johnson as a physical and emotional clone of Donald Trump. And this question was put to Boris Johnson earlier, how he plans to deal with Joe Biden, knowing Biden's ambivalence towards him, and also how can he explain to Biden that Brexit wasn't a mistake, as Biden has said he believes it was.
There is far more that unites the government of this country and government in Washington any stage than divides us. We have common values, we have common interests, we have a common global perspective. There's a huge amount of work we need to do together to protect those values.
As you can hear, Boris Johnson doesn't actually answer the question. The reality is he's more than aware that he needs to get on Biden's good side while he's trying to negotiate a trade deal with the EU.
Let me swing back to Southern Europe for one more hit from you, Lydia. We've seen rising tensions recently between Greece and Turkey. Are people watching to see how Biden will weigh in?
Yes, absolutely. So the tensions between the two countries have been rising, as you said, over the last few months, because Turkey has been exploring and drilling for natural gas in the Eastern Mediterranean in areas that are claimed by both Greece and Cyprus. And if you turn on the TV here, you think that the two countries, Greece and Turkey, are about to go to war. So I was speaking about this earlier with Alexander Skoudas. He's a Greek-American who actually helped run Republican Ron Paul's presidential campaign in 2012, and he now heads KEFIM, a think tank here in Athens, Greece. He said that the Trump administration had sent mixed messages on this issue, and they didn't take a strong stance.
The alleged friendship of President Trump with the president of Turkey raised a lot of eyebrows in Greece. So we're all very anxious to find out what the situation is going to look like during the Biden era, because this is a very important issue in Greece.
And how this administration handles Turkey is going to be closely watched, not just by Greece, because there are many critics around the world who believe that Trump has taken a really soft stance and hasn't sanctioned Turkey for things like controversial weapons purchases, human rights violations. So again, what, if anything, new this administration does with Turkey and whether it takes a harder line on Turkey is going to be of interest to people not just in this region, but beyond.
I mean, it's going to be fascinating to see how Europe adjusts to the incoming Biden administration, full stop. It'll be a big change. Lydia Emanuelidou, the world's correspondent in Athens, Greece, and Orla Barry, the world's correspondent in London, England. Thank you both very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
You're welcome, Marco.
If the election got you in the habit of constantly refreshing your browser, we've got the solution to detoxify from the numbers. Subscribe to our morning newsletter, Top of the World. Sign up theworld.org/newsletters. You're with the world. Here's a reminder. The world is free for anyone, on air, on demand, and on the web. We report stories from around the globe with nuance, context, and by listening to voices of people most affected by the news. Do your part today to help us keep access to the world free. And right now, when you donate, your contribution will be doubled. The World is participating in Newsmatch, a campaign to raise money for high-quality, independent journalism. To donate, go to theworld.org/give or follow the link right here in the episode notes. Stay safe, stay healthy, and thank you. Vice President-elect Kamala Harris is making history in a lot of ways. Her sorority sisters couldn't be happier.
Frankly, to be part of the same organization as Senator Harris is nothing short of a privilege for us all around the world, even here in South Africa.
The first Alpha Kappa Alpha in the White House? That's coming up soon here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We come to you from GBH Boston and PRX. Across the globe, leaders are congratulating Joe Biden on his victory in the U.S. election. Some, however, are not picking up the phone since President Trump is refusing to concede. China, for one. Here's Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin at a weekend press conference.
We note that Mr. Biden has declared victory. We understand that the result of the U.S. presidential election will be determined following U.S. laws and procedures.
The translation there provided by Reuters. For now, China is sidestepping a formal recognition of Joe Biden as the U.S. president-elect. Taiwan, on the other hand, has taken the opposite stance. President Tsai Ing-wen has said that she looks forward to working together to further our friendship and contributions to international society. Here's a headline from Formosa Television, Taiwanese English TV news.
Early Sunday morning, President Tsai Ing-wen congratulated Biden on Twitter. She also attached a congratulatory tweet that Biden had sent her when she was re-elected president earlier this year.
That's Taiwan, though. For now, the tension between the U.S. and the People's Republic of China continues. Trump's prolonged trade war with China has strained relations even before he stepped into the White House, and he's repeatedly blamed China for the pandemic. The friction between the U.S. and China has led to ripple effects across business, culture, and sports. That is the focus of our next story. The NBA has been mounting a full-court charm press, hoping to rebuild business ties with China. And good news for sports fans came last month when China State Television decided to lift a year-long ban on basketball games. The World's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai has the backstory on the NBA's campaign to get back on the air.
Recent college grad Chris Chiao lives in China's northern Shanxi province. Like many young Chinese sports fans, he used to check NBA highlights on his phone every morning after waking up. A year ago, he saw a piece of news that shocked him. The general manager of the Houston Rockets, Daryl Morey, tweeted support for pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong.
Daryl Morey says he didn't intend to offend Chinese fans and friends.
But what in America was seen as freedom of expression had hit a hot-button issue in China, the status of Hong Kong. For Chiao, it was enough for him to stop watching. The tweet really hurt people's feelings and crossed a line, says Chiao. It made me feel he didn't respect us, so why should we still keep watching NBA? Many others had the same question, including the Chinese government. Soon, an announcement came from state-run television.
CCTV Sports Channel has just announced that it will suspend the broadcast of any NBA games in China, including this week's preseason games.
This was a disaster for the NBA. There are more NBA fans here in China than there are people in the U.S. Billions of dollars are wrapped up in the game here. NBA teams and players have merchandising deals, advertising agreements, sponsorships. A lot of that got canceled. A few days after the TV ban, Shanghai hosted an NBA exhibition game. Some fans boycotted. This man filmed himself ripping up his tickets to the game. But plenty of other fans said they kept watching their favorite sport. These young basketball players at a public court in Shanghai say the ban didn't impact them at all. They just watched online. This man wearing a Lakers jersey says, "I can't give up the NBA. The way they handled the incident upset us, but we still follow our favorite teams. If the Lakers are playing, I'll be watching." That's the case for a lot of fans, says Joseph Krasenstein, director of marketing at a company that helps NBA players reach out to their Chinese audience.
People will still authentically follow their favorite icons and their idols. And I think that fandom never stopped. If anything, I think the fans doubled down in their fandom and their efforts to keep connected to their favorite stars.
But the fact is, China's refusal to air NBA games on TV was a huge problem, one that the NBA tried to fix through both public and private gestures. At games broadcast in the U.S. at the start of the pandemic, it put up big signs and videos saying, "Go Wuhan." It also sent medical equipment and PPE there. NBA players also reached out to fans directly with messages and donations.
This is David Robinson.
This is Scottie Pippen.
Every year, players film Chinese New Year greetings and other content for their Chinese fans. But this year, they tailored their videos to fans in lockdown.
We just want to send our thoughts
to the people of Wuhan. You are in my thoughts.
My prayers and all my fellow teammates and friends' prayers are going your way.
But the NBA also made some structural changes. For one, it hired a Chinese national to head up NBA China for the first time ever. Tensions continued between the NBA and China. But as the LA Lakers and the Miami Heat went into the final playoff games, China lifted the TV ban and broadcast the last two games. CCTV said what made the difference was the care the NBA showed during the pandemic and its good wishes during a national holiday celebrating the founding of modern-day China. Susan Brownell is an anthropologist at University of Missouri, St. Louis, who studies sports in China. She says the NBA's efforts to appease China were part of a political dance,
I don't know if the NBA was clever enough to have done that intentionally, but they did manage to hit the two biggest culturally important things, which is to support Chinese sovereignty and to express concern for the health of Chinese citizens.
Joseph Krasenstein, the sports marketer, says he can only imagine the kind of negotiations that went on behind closed doors.
You know, there's a lot of things happening behind the scenes with a lot of very influential people on both sides, from the government side to the distribution broadcasting side to also the NBA China side. They've all worked super hard to get back to a level of open dialogue and commitment to pushing the game further in China.
5 days after China lifted the TV ban, Daryl Morey, the Houston Rockets general manager, announced he would leave the team and later joined the Philadelphia 76ers. Susan Brownell says that historically, China has used organized sports to build bridges with other nations and sometimes to burn them.
I think China has the government has a very, very long memory when it comes to who our friends are. So punishing people economically, that does have a long history going back at least to 1989. But they didn't have that much economic clout then. Now they have much more economic clout in the world, and I definitely think it's an official strategy that they will be using as much as they can.
She thinks international sports organizations should take note and tread carefully. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
Historic and inspiring. Those words from a Palestinian diplomat reacting to the news that Joe Biden will become the next U.S. president. The past 4 years of the Trump administration have not been good for the Palestinian Authority. So what kinds of changes in U.S. policy are they hoping to see under a Biden-Harris administration? Hanan Ashrawi is a senior official with the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, and joins me from Ramallah. When Trump was elected in 2016, there was a statement from the Palestinians that they hoped they could work with them. How well have things gone, would you say?
Things have gone in a disastrous way. It's been really an unmitigated catastrophe. Working with or not working with Trump has in many ways threatened the whole Palestinian issue and cause. Trump decided from the beginning that he's going to bash the Palestinians into submission. He's going to not only side with Israel, but protect its impunity and join it as a partner in crime and in occupation. And he moved in many ways unilaterally and illegally in order to preempt all Palestinian issues. So we had to survive these 4 years. They were extremely dangerous, they were extremely painful, and the very building blocks of peace were being systematically destroyed.
Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority president, congratulated Biden and Harris after the news of their win over the weekend. But, I mean, based on what you're saying, Hanan Ashrawi, what are the Palestinian Authority and Abbas realistically hoping for from a Biden administration?
First of all, we hope to stop the damage. This is very important. We have to stop this slippery slope, and we have to prevent also in the transition between now and January from delivering even more to Israel. So this is one thing. But two, we have to try to forge a new way ahead, not by going back to the way things were before, because the problem is that American policy has failed repeatedly in bringing about a just peace, in curbing Israeli violations, in protecting Palestinian rights. So we cannot go back to doing more of the same, hoping for a different result. Palestine now is part of the American conversation. It is no longer a taboo. We are part of a movement. We are part of an awareness of the need to respect human rights, to treat people equally, to respect the global rule of law, and to move ahead in ways that are different from the usual let AIPAC and let the pro-Israel lobby decide on American policy in the Middle East.
And just a reminder, AIPAC, the American-Israel Political Action Committee. What more damage are you worried about in the next 3 months before Trump leaves the White House? I mean, Netanyahu came out with a warm congratulations for Biden.
You believe that? Netanyahu, I think, feels that he's lost his best friend because Trump was working for Netanyahu. Trump was delivering everything that Netanyahu wanted. and at the same time pandering to his base in the U.S. So now he feels that he can no longer dictate American policy when it comes to Palestine. In many ways, they still are capable of doing more damage, like enabling the overt and so on annexation of 30% of the West Bank or of all the settlements and so on. They can do a lot of damage, and I don't want to give them any suggestions or ideas, please.
As a result of the Trump White House, the Palestinians have boycotted Washington for 3 years. Will that boycott end?
The U.S. disqualified itself as a peace broker or as an interlocutor because it became part of the occupation. And it violated the law and our rights. So in a sense, the moment the Trump plan is off the table, the moment all these prejudicial and illegal steps are stopped and undone, of course, the reasons for the suspension of dialogue and talks will be removed.
I mean, the Palestinian boycott of Washington basically came as a result of the move of the embassy to Jerusalem and recognizing Jerusalem as the capital. Biden has essentially said he won't change that.
Well, that's why they need to reconsider, because they cannot be part of an illegal position. 14 out of 15 Security Council members, with the exception, of course, of the U.S., voted against this. And there is a very easy way out. You took an illegal decision that was rejected by the rest of the world. You can undo that.
Hanan Ashrawi, you've had decades of international diplomatic experience. What do you think Joe Biden brings to the job in terms of the interests of Palestinians?
Well, look, we have no illusions. He is no savior. We know him and we know Kamala Harris. And we know that they have very strong AIPAC ties. And we know that they have all been very pro-Israeli. But they cannot afford to do more of the same now. And I think they should engage the Palestinians as equals, as people with equal rights. And they should also engage Israel as a country that is not above the law, but that has to be held to account.
Hanan Ashrawi is a senior official of the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO. Thank you so much for your time today.
You're most welcome.
A COVID-19 vaccine that is 90% effective. That is the hope offered by pharma giant Pfizer today in preliminary analysis from the clinical trial of its vaccine that's being developed with a German drug maker. Here to help us break down what this might mean is Saad Omar, director of Yale's Institute for Global Health. He's been active in the National Academy of Medicine and World Health Organization panels on COVID-19 vaccines. Saad Omar, thanks for being with us. This announcement comes from Pfizer itself, so outside experts have not reviewed the analysis yet. But what do you make of this claim? What would it mean if a vaccine were 90% effective?
Obviously, we need more data to be more definitive about these outcomes. But from the surface of it, it's good news. It's a good news both in terms of the fact that they're reporting 90% efficacy. But one concern we had was that this vaccine would work differentially in older populations versus younger populations, like influenza, where that's what we see. But if with that high in efficacy and knowing the overall composition of their trial population, it gives me some reassurance that even if there are differences by age, they're not likely to be that large, at least based on this initial data.
So tell us what you know about this Pfizer vaccine. How does it work?
So this is an mRNA vaccine, so messenger RNA vaccine that works through signaling to the cell what is desired rather than presenting an antigen or a protein or something or a whole organism around which an immune response is mounted. One advantage these vaccines are that they're rather quick to develop compared to other technologies once you have identified the virus.
Well, you kind of alluded to it there, so maybe you don't have the answer, but how could this vaccine be scaled up and what are the opportunities and challenges when it comes to who has access to it around the globe?
So we know that we'll have to do some prioritization of various groups. In the U.S., it's the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine that came up with the prioritization scheme. Similarly, WHO has a roadmap for prioritizing various groups, and the supply won't be enough for the whole population. So that's a big challenge. The good news is that Pfizer has already done some production, a few million doses, even prior to approval, so that if the vaccine gets approved, they are ready to go. but we should be realistic about the fact that there will be some time before most of the world will be vaccinated.
There's already some perhaps premature excitement in stock markets to this news, but what do you make of these results? I mean, if it's not published, what questions do you have, Saad Omar?
Yeah, so I have several questions. First of all, I want to look at the actual data in terms of at what point they saw efficacy in terms of the follow-up period. What were the characteristics of various subgroups in terms of their relative efficacy? What was the immune response like, the biological response? In terms of safety data, what were some of the safety considerations they had in terms of some of the events? They will be presenting their safety data to FDA after at least 2 months of follow-up after the second dose. So this should not be, from a public health perspective, the end of story in terms of vaccine development.
One last thing, Saad Omar. President-elect Joe Biden, as you know, has released an outline for taking on COVID-19. That includes a task force with several of your Yale colleagues in public health. Globally, what does this action mean in this moment?
I think it signals that the scientific enterprise within the U.S. will be utilized to its potential going forward. The composition of the group signals that the focus is on science. And so that reassures the world. That reassures that the data coming out of the U.S. can be used by other regulatory agencies, can be used by public health decision makers to make their own decisions without having to go through the process themselves. Obviously, countries look at their own data, but you could look towards the U.S. data and you can say, okay, if the FDA has approved it, there is credibility behind it. So therefore, I think the overall signal is good for the world.
Saad Omar directs Yale's Institute for Global Health. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Last week's election resulted in a triple first. The first woman, the first South Asian woman, the first Black woman to be elected vice president.
Women who fought and sacrificed so much for equality and liberty and justice for all, including the Black women who are often too often overlooked, but so often prove they are the backbone of our democracy.
Senator Kamala Harris is an alum of Howard, a historically Black university, where she was a member of the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority. If you know about AKA, you know it's an international network with chapters in Canada, Liberia, Germany, Dubai, and the Virgin Islands, to name a few. Ashley Whitfield is the president of Alpha Kappa Alpha's chapter in Johannesburg, South Africa, and she's with us. Ashley, what does it mean for you to see an AKA member rise to one of the most powerful positions in the U.S. and the world, really?
It's actually not really possible to put to words the pride that I feel right now. The truth is, if I can be honest, hearing her voice brought chills to me in a way that I wasn't really expecting. To have listened to that speech again has made me a bit emotive, actually, because it is true that I actually don't have the words to describe how important this moment is.
As you were listening to the senator just now, what came to you that made you feel that way? I mean, what were you hearing?
I suppose what I was hearing was just the reverberations of our ancestors, who fought so hard to get to a moment where Black women and all people would have representation and hopefully have things that we share in common represented at the White House. Being the first Black woman, she comes with experiences and a history that we have not been able to fairly represent yet at the federal level. And frankly, to be part of the same organization as Senator Harris is nothing short of a privilege for us all around the world, even here in South Africa.
Well, you say even here in South Africa. I understand Senator Harris actually has a special connection to the AKA chapter in South Africa. What is that?
Yes. So in a Washington Post interview, Senator Harris actually ascribed her initial interest in Alpha Kappa Alpha to Christine Simmons. Christine Simmons actually took her with her to service activities when Senator Harris was a child. And Christine Simmons, who graduated from Howard and became a member at Howard in the early 1950s, actually retired here to South Africa in 2010. Senator Harris called Christine Simmons Auntie Chris. And we shared that sort of sentiment here in Johannesburg because she absolutely took us under her wing as nieces here in South Africa.
I mean, what you're telling me, Ashley, points to the fact that Alpha Kappa Alpha is more than a sorority, more than a campus social club. It really is an international network. What are the goals of the AKA organization? What does it mean to be a part of this network at a global level?
The main purpose of our sorority is service. We do that through sisterhood, and we actually do that through really rolling up our sleeves and supporting the community as best as we can. So as an example, here in South Africa, we provide about 200 sandwiches every week to young children in need. And many of these young children are also heads of their household. So we're talking children who are actually the oldest person in their family. So in working collectively, we constantly affirm our sisterhood because we know that through our sisterhood, we can make a huge difference in our community.
How do you see those values being enacted upon by Vice President-elect Senator Harris? Do you see that in her leadership style?
I think it would be impossible not to. When we had the opportunity to listen to her a couple days ago when she became Vice President-elect, the grace and, again, the generosity, as we've seen role modeled through many women who are part of our organization, it's just absolutely clear. We also know that Senator Harris has taken up the fight on key issues such as Black women's high rates of fatality and childbirth and a number of other very important things that impact our community disproportionately.
And I can only imagine the conversation among AKA members around the globe on one of your sisters making it as Vice President-elect of the United States. What's that been like?
I actually have to admit here that I'm not on social media, so I get forwarded a lot of the memes and the photographs.
Can I just tell you how refreshing that sounds that you're not on social media?
No, yeah. But because I, as you can hear, I am from the States and I live in South Africa and I have sorority members who I'm close to who are spread across the globe. And we have been sort of swapping these memes to each other on WhatsApp and just, you know, really, as we always do, holding our head up high, but perhaps even just a little bit higher in this moment as we all Black women everywhere, I believe, celebrate this amazing accomplishment.
Ashley Whitfield is the president of the Alpha Kappa Alpha chapter in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for being with us today, Ashley. Good to meet you.
Good to meet you too.
Longtime Jeopardy host Alex Trebek died Sunday at the age of 80. In an era when facts at times seem up for debate, Trebek was a standard bearer with a show known for intellectual rigor. Trebek was born in Ontario and got his start in broadcasting at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
Good morning. Here is the CBC National News read by Alec Trebek. First, the main items.
Trebek's father was a Ukrainian immigrant and his mom French-Canadian. Alex was the only bilingual announcer on the English-speaking staff at the time, which he says opened doors.
Alex Trebek.
Merci beaucoup. Bonsoir, mesdames et messieurs, et bienvenue à ce match Reach for the Top, Génie en herbe, qui a deux buts.
That was Trebek in his 20s. Before he started his 37 years as the host of Jeopardy, he made a name for himself in Canada. Here he is on the Canadian version of American Bandstand.
Hi, kids. Welcome back to Music Off. Today, we're going to kick things off with a fellow we had on the show earlier this year. So here he is, the number one singing idol of French Canada, Pierre Lalonde, to sing Fools Rush In.
Trebek was a private man, but when he was diagnosed with cancer, he said he wanted to tell his viewers himself, and he did.
Just like 50,000 other people in the United States each year, this week I was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer.
That was last year. Today, we say goodbye, one of many in this period of loss. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online 24/7 at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Stay safe, be strong, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.